The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Canada passes a ban on so-called conversion therapy.
Make no mistake, it's directed to the pulpit.
America, or at least part of America, is waking up to our new reality with China.
It is unprecedented in the history of our nation that we have faced an adversary as formidable and as ambitious as this one.
And we'll look at Christian faithfulness in the face of persecution and imprisonment.
Sister Tong got a smile on her face. I really would call it a heavenly smile. And she said something in Chinese, and the translator said, "Oh, yes, that was a wonderful time."
I'm Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. You can catch my program each weekday through our live stream at WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. And take a moment to follow the Christian Outlook on Twitter at TC Outlook. That's TC Outlook. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin with the issue of religious liberty, and we'll start not right here at home, but in Canada and in the United Kingdom. Most immediately, our neighbor to the north has passed a ban on what they have labeled conversion therapy. That ban took effect as we headed into the weekend on January 7th. It raises a host of issues about religious liberty, including what happens within the context of the ministry of the church. Albert Moeller took a closer look from his briefing program.
Let's get to the biggest issue of Christian concern. These particular bills could have the effect of chilling the preaching, restricting the liberty of the pulpit in Christian churches, and even could extend to potentially criminalizing personal conversations and even outlawing certain kinds of conversations between parents and children. You say, how could that happen? Well, it is happening. And we have seen this coming. We've seen this issue, this challenge taking shape. And you see now the fact that many who are writing what they consider to be and claim to be a platform of sexual liberation are not only calling for a change in the laws, they're not only changing the entire society, they want to criminalize and sanction and make illegal any confrontation on biblical terms of their own new morality. Looking first to the developments in Canada, Rachel Treisman of National Public Radio in the United States reports, quote, "Canada has formally banned conversion therapy, the widely discredited practice aimed at changing a person's sexual orientation or gender identity." That Canadian legislation, by the way, will go into effect on January the 7th. The text of the Canadian bill says that conversion therapy, as it is called, is wrong because it is, quote, "based on and propagates myths and stereotypes about sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression, including the myth that heterosexuality, cisgender gender identity," that means non-transgender gender identity, "and gender expression that conforms to the sex assigned to a person at birth are to be preferred over other sexual orientations, gender identities, and gender expressions," end quote. Now, if you were looking for just one series of words that would encapsulate the entirety of the modern rebellion against God's order, well, there you have it. Just consider the language here. Explicitly, you now have the text of legislation that will take the effect of law in Canada that states that any belief that anything that is arrayed along LGBTQ is in any way inferior to any other sexual pattern, that is wrong, it is a myth, and it is outlawed in many contexts. The main thrust of this legislation is towards outlawing any kind of therapeutic context that would make a moral judgment consistent with Christianity in this case. But the bigger threat is, of course, that this will be extended throughout society inexorably, unavoidably, to every other context, including Christian institutions, Christian organizations, and even Christian churches. This is legislation that no one in Canada wants to admit is directed to the pulpit, but make no mistake, it's directed to the pulpit. It's also directed at parents. This is a new morality which now comes with not only the persuasive power of the government of the state, but now with the coercive power of the state, even criminalization.
Of course, our concerns as we enter the new year are not limited to religious liberty in the West. Throughout 2021, as we have been distracted by our own polarized political environment, we watched as China made clear what has really been their ambition for quite some time. I turned to Frank Gaffney of the Center for Security Policy.
I think it's become increasingly apparent to everybody in the course of 2021 that the Chinese Communist Party is at war with our country. Now, it hasn't, fortunately, to this point, been the old-fashioned kind of kinetic warfare, but they've used what they call unrestricted warfare techniques against us for decades now. And by that, they mean essentially anything goes. Economic warfare is perhaps the most obvious place, the decimation of our industrial base, for example, the theft of our intellectual property and high technology, the subversion of our elites, as well as our academic institutions, our media, our cultural enterprises in Hollywood. The degree to which this has been going on long before what I call the Chinese Communist Party virus turned up is something that most of us have missed, frankly. And even today, I think quite a number in both political parties, unfortunately, have either chosen to look the other way or simply not really comprehended the implications of this kind of not only unrestricted warfare, but unreciprocated warfare against this nation. So when you ask the question about, you know, how big a problem is this? I would say it is unprecedented in the history of our nation that we have faced an adversary as formidable and as ambitious as this one, and that has stolen a march on us, frankly, as a result of our inattention, to put us at risk, not only in the Western Pacific, East Asia area, of course, but now increasingly globally as well.
And on top of that, an incredible new level of abuse of human rights and religious rights in their own country. China's been guilty of that, as have other nations, for some decades, but it seems that's been ratcheted up as well.
You're absolutely right. In the course of February, we're going to hear very little about that as countries across the planet legitimate the perpetrators of what I think are properly described as the genocide games. They're, of course, the Winter Olympics, but in practice, what they are is an opportunity for a nation to do much as Adolf Hitler's Third Reich did in 1936 when it used the Summer Olympics, in that case, in Berlin, to essentially demonstrate that the entire world was going to go along with and enable the Nazis to act with impunity as a result, even in the face of this incredible barbarity at home and aggression abroad. And I fear that you'll see a similar kind of response by the Chinese to that kind of legitimation by the world's community, probably resulting in not only increasing repression of the Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities in Western China, in Tibet, in southern Mongolia, in Hong Kong, but also almost certainly attacks against Taiwan and perhaps even India, presumably after these Olympics.
So the boycotting, so-called, that has been proposed or planned is really tokenism as far as I'm concerned. It really should be, in my view, what do you think, a total, absolute boycott of the Olympics altogether. That would make an impact, would it not?
I think it would. It's certainly our duty to punish the perpetrators of that genocide. Our government has formally, under both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, formally designated the Chinese Communist Party as agents of this genocidal behavior, and far from punishing them or even really holding them accountable in any other way, we are going to be, as you say, Don, rewarding them. That is only going to conduce to more bad behavior on the part of these fellows, and I'm fearful that it will increasingly be the case that it won't be restricted to their own people. After all, a government that treats their own people this horrifically is unlikely to be very kind to ours or others.
Speaking of that, this whole concept of evil versus good and the spiritual forces behind all of this hostility and anger and persecution of people of faith, especially Christians and others in not only China and Russia and throughout other parts of the world, but we've talked recently about Nigeria and continue to do so. I know you're tracking that. Give your assessment of the situation there in terms of the Christians in Nigeria and others who are suffering at the hands of the radical Islamists.
Don, I so appreciate your calling attention to this because it is being neglected terribly and for far too long. It's a microcosm of a larger problem, as we've discussed in the past. By some estimates, including those of Open Doors, there are 340 million Christians around the world who are being not just persecuted, but heavily persecuted. And a good number of them are in Nigeria, where about half the country of 200 million is Christian, and the other half is increasingly, not all, needless to say, but a sufficient number of them, radicalized Sharia supremacist jihadist Muslims who are bent on driving those Christians either to an early death or certainly out of their homes and territory, and ideally, as far as the Fulani militants, for example, or Boko Haram, or the Islamic State of West Africa are concerned, drive them out of the country altogether, which is one of the reasons why I think it is just imperative that the United States government become engaged very directly. You know, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, went to Nigeria, and on the eve of his trip, he removed that country from a status known as country of special concern. He then proceeded, when he was there, to talk about the importance of respecting religious freedom and preserving liberty in that regard and so on. It was completely undermined, that message, by his State Department's conduct. And I'm afraid it is, again, only emboldening these terrible, diabolical bad actors, and again, at the expense of millions of our co-religionists who have done nothing to deserve it, you know? And that's unfortunately been true, as I say, elsewhere around the world, including one of the places we talked about a moment ago, China, where Christians are also being horrifically persecuted. But the worst of it is taking place, unfortunately, in Muslim nations where it is believed by these Sharia supremacists, as I call them, that it is their divine right to oppress Christians and Jews and people of other faiths as well.
Coming up, persecuted and imprisoned for Christ.
Sister Tong got a smile on her face. I really would call it a heavenly smile. And she said something in Chinese, and the translator said, "Oh, yes, that was a wonderful time."
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Frank Gaffney provided helpful insight for us as we watch China become increasingly assertive in their overworking of the communist vision of President Xi. And we also have our own concerns about the future of religious liberty here at home. Perhaps it's fitting, then, for us to take a look at the stories of men and women who have been faithful in the face of persecution. Todd Nettleton is Chief of Media Relations for the ministry Voice of the Martyrs. He's also the author of the book, When Faith is Forbidden. Todd was a guest on my program here in Washington, D.C.
I was just thinking of the verse our Lord gave us in the Beatitudes. You're blessed when men persecute you and say all manner of evil against you for my sake. How do you define persecution? Because certainly you've already indicated it can be a beating. It can be even worse, death itself. But what other forms would define persecution for Christians?
You know, I think it does take many forms. And the bottom line is when someone is forced to pay a price because they follow Jesus. And in some countries, that looks like discrimination. Hey, you know, your children can't go to school. If you're going to be a Christian, we're not going to let your children attend the public school. In other places, it literally means your life. I think of North Korea, where if you're found to have a Bible, you're going to a political prisoner camp where you will probably die. You will probably never walk out of there free again. And so persecution looks very different, but it's interesting that you quote that verse, because Jesus did say that we're blessed when that happens. And I think of the story in Acts chapter 5 of the apostles taken before the Sanhedrin. They were beaten and sent on their way, and the Bible says they left the council rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer for the name of Christ. They saw this as a blessing. They saw this as a compliment from God, that they were allowed to suffer for the name of Christ. That's still the attitude that our brothers and sisters around the world have. They have that sense of joy. They have that sense of excitement. Hey, look what God is doing in my country, and he let me be a part of it. Isn't that amazing? That's the attitude that comes through in so many of these stories in this book.
I know that you're well aware, many of our listeners are as well, of the verses we just referenced. Also, Hebrews 13 reminds us to remember those in adversity, those being persecuted, those in prison, as though we were part of the body, literally being part of their sufferings. Why is it important, Todd, for us to understand that our brothers and sisters are really going through some terrible times? And what will that do for them, but also what does it do for us?
Well, the scripture tells us that when one part of the body suffers, the other parts of the body are supposed to respond to that. They're supposed to be connected enough that when one part suffers, we all suffer. If we're completely disconnected, if we don't know, if we have no knowledge, we can't follow that scripture. We're not connected enough to really feel their pain. The things that grow out of that, and it's really two directions, going towards persecuted Christians, we can pray for them, we can encourage them, we can stand with them in practical ways, we can send help, we can send Bibles, we can be a blessing to them during their time of persecution. The traffic that comes the other way, though, is the blessing of seeing their testimonies and the blessing of seeing their faithfulness and, more importantly, God's faithfulness. The fact that God is faithful even in a prison cell, God is faithful even when someone is enduring a beating for the name of Christ. He not only enables them to withstand that beating, but he supernaturally allows them to love their persecutor and forgive their persecutor. When we hear those stories, it encourages our faith, and it makes us want to be more bold in following Christ ourselves.
What are some of the things you learned? I mean, even after all the years you've done this, I have to believe there were some stories you witnessed, you gathered as you traveled, that really must have moved you very deeply. What are some of those stories maybe that stick in your mind the most often?
One of the stories that always sticks in my mind comes from early on in my time at BOM. We interviewed a lady in China named Sister Tong, and Sister Tong had just been released after serving 6 months in prison. She hosted a house church meeting at her home. That's why she went to prison. And so we sat down with her just a few weeks after she was released, and I said, Sister Tong, tell me about the prison. And, you know, in my mind, I'm saying, okay, tell me how hard the bed was. Tell me how cold it was. Tell me how big the rats were. And my translator translated the question, and Sister Tong got a smile on her face. I really would call it a heavenly smile. and she said something in Chinese, and the translator said, oh, yes, that was a wonderful time. And I honestly, I thought he had not translated the question correctly, because I'm like, there's no way that she could describe prison as being a wonderful time. But she went on to share, and she said, you know, Jesus was so close to me in prison. He was with me every moment, every day, every hour. He was so close to me, and that precious fellowship with him was special to me. And she said, you know what else? There were other ladies in my cell, and they didn't know Christ when I got there, but I had the chance to share Jesus with them and to pray with them, and they are now following Jesus Christ. So for 6 months, I had the amazing presence of Christ, and he gave me opportunities to be a witness for him. And so she really thought of 6 months in prison as being a wonderful time. And that totally blew my mind. I did not have a way of thinking about prison or thinking about suffering as being wonderful. And it totally changed the way I think about persecution, the way I think about hardship. And I have carried that lesson all those years later. And that's why she's one of the stories that I have in this brand new book.
And I understand there's another story similar in there of an Iranian imam who said his time of persecution, I think you quote him as saying, was the sweetest time of his life. What's that story about?
Yes, he said the time in prison was the sweetest time of my life. His name was Iman, and just amazing story. He came to Christ out of a life of drug addiction, out of a life of crime. Jesus rescued him from all of that, and he talked about the time in prison being the sweetest time in his life, and he shared a cell with 100 other prisoners. And over the time that he was in that cell, he was able to share Christ with all of those prisoners, and 24 of them prayed and received Christ with him in that prison cell. When Iman came out of the prison cell, he sent his regular monthly report to his leaders, his church leaders. He said, you know, in the last month, I shared Christ with 100 people, and 24 of them prayed with me and received Christ and committed their lives to Christ. He didn't mention at all the fact that he had done this ministry in prison, and his leaders found that out several weeks later, and they're like, Iman, wait a minute, why didn't you tell us you were in prison? And to him, it didn't matter where he was. It only mattered that he'd had opportunity to share Christ and that people had received Christ. If it was prison or if it was at the store or if it was at the beach, that part was unimportant. The part that mattered to him was, hey, I got to tell people about Jesus, and some of them accepted him.
Coming up, Christian courage in an increasingly hostile world.
And I got a lot of Christians saying, you're being alarmist. Things really aren't that bad. Well, here comes COVID, and here comes race riots and the militant wokeness now within institutions.
Rod Dreher, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. Over the course of these last 2 years, we have witnessed quite the revolutionary spirit in our nation. We saw countless statues pulled down. We saw rampant rioting and looting, with local elected leaders unwilling to enforce the rule of law. DAs, the district attorneys, for a number of major metropolitan areas, are left-wing radicals. As we see this hard-left intellectual movement take root in our country, Christians need to be prepared to live faithfully through challenging times. Rod Dreher's new book is titled, Live Not by Lies. And he's learning lessons from families that lived through the communist era. He joined Albert Mohler for his Thinking in Public program.
This book is not only an argument, it's very emotionally moving. And I think you probably intended it to be so.
I did. This is really more a book of storytelling. The heart of the book is made of my interviews with Christians in the former Soviet bloc and in Russia who came through the communist yoke and who have stories about that, that they want American Christians to know so we can prepare ourselves for what they see correctly, I think, as a different kind of totalitarianism that's coming upon us.
I have to wonder if between the time you set out this argument and when we're having this conversation. You've had further thoughts about the distinction between hard and soft totalitarianism. Play that out a bit for us.
I've been thinking about it for a while, and I finally sold the book proposal in early 2019, turned the manuscript in at me and thought, you know, how am I going to sell this book to my fellow Christians? I believe the argument is solid that we're on the verge of a soft totalitarianism. But I remember with the Benedict option, I got a lot of Christians saying you're being alarmist. Things really aren't that bad. Well, then, since I turned the final manuscript in, here comes COVID and here comes race riots and the militant wokeness now within institutions, within college campuses, within journalism, within big business that's really transforming these environments. I don't think now that I have nearly as much of a challenge selling the argument to Christians who are the least bit observant as I would have just 6-7 months ago.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of trace this through in intellectual history for just a bit and the history of the 20th century. The Marxists were very frustrated that the revolution that became known in Russia as the Bolshevik Revolution, they thought it would happen in a city like London or Berlin, and especially the more industrialized, the more class dominated and all the rest. It didn't happen. And by the time you get to the period between the two wars in the 20th century, and then especially afterwards, you've got people on the left making the judgment that there's no way. People are just too far along in a consumer society that there's going to be anything like a Bolshevik revolution in London or Washington or, you know, Chicago. And so instead, the European Marxists said, we've got to do the long march through the institutions, as you use the language. But it seems to me that when you're talking about this soft totalitarianism, it's actually kind of the backside of that. So if the Bolshevik Revolution didn't happen in London and in Washington, or for that matter, in Rome and in Paris, because we're kind of far along in a consumer society and all the rest, one of the interesting points you make, and we're reading the same stuff, is that it's that very consumer society that becomes the engines of the soft totalitarianism.
Right, right. The Bolsheviks sought to, and the Orthodox Marxists sought to capture the means of economic production. But what these neo-Marxists have done, and they did this in the 1960s, there was an interesting flip when everybody lost faith in the communist economic model. They decided to make the capturing the means of cultural production their goal. And that's what happened. This is when identity politics in the late 60s, early 70s began to supplant class politics in the Marxist mind. And it turns out that this goes quite well with advanced capitalism. You know, right. once you can tell people that who they are is what they will, what they desire, well, you can sell them a lot of products that way. And so this is why one of the reasons I think that we've lived long enough to see big business, big capitalism become march hand in hand with the woke revolution. Because it's all about constructing an identity out of your own desires. But unfortunately, I believe that capitalism is going to see, it has created the grounds for its own dissolution because of this.
And the totalitarianism is there, and Americans know it, but are just kind of apparently okay with it.
Yeah.
Shoshana Zuboff in her book, Age of Surveillance Capitalism, I pointed many people to that book saying, look, they're not going to come and take your freedom. You're giving it away. We all are, by the way.
You know, if somebody from the government came to our front doors here in America and said, we would like to install this speaker, it's going to make your life, your consumer life, so much easier. It's called Alexa. Make your life easier. It'll also be listening to what you say and transmitting it back to a company. We would know right away what that was, and we would tell them no. But if a big business can come to us and tell us it can make our lives easier, if we'll pay them money to put it in our house. This is the way that they're doing this right under our nose, completely legally, with our consent.
Coming up,
I think the left has all the cultural high ground now. Make no mistake about it. They are controlling all the institutions.
More with Rod Dreher when the Christian Outlook continues in just a moment. Stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow.
As we look at this dynamic and challenging period of history we are living through, the Christian has both a great advantage and a particular challenge. The advantage, of course, is that this world is not our home. Come good, come ill, come what may, the genuine believer knows that the great hope is beyond this world. And the challenge is becoming all too clear. Convictional Christians are on a collision course with an increasingly intolerant left. Let's pick up with more of the conversation of Rod Dreher with Albert Mohler.
I want to take us back into the book. There are certain books that I think at a certain moment are really, really helpful to the church. And I really believe that your book, Live Not by Lies, is one of those. I didn't have to be told where the title came from. A part of my intellectual adventure in life is that through being a 16-year-old reading National Review magazine and the University Bookman and things like that, I came to know of Solzhenitsyn. And then, of course, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And it was very much a part of international conversation. But then through being active in politics, I came to know, you know, of even the situation when Gerald Ford refused to meet with Solzhenitsyn, you know, one of the great presidential errors of modern American history. But Solzhenitsyn was just a part of how I learned to think in what I would say are profoundly more Augustinian terms. And it was it's a young evangelical Protestant kind of comes to terms with evil by reading Solzhenitsyn. This was his final address to the Russian people, or the Soviet people. Tell us what's going on when Solzhenitsyn says, "Live not by lies."
Yeah, the Soviets were on the verge of kicking him out of the country, exiling him to the West. Last thing he wrote in 1974, he sent a communique to them through Samizdat under the title, "Live Not by Lies." It's a short little essay in which he told them, look, people may say that we can do nothing as ordinary people against this kingdom of lies, this totalitarian tyranny, but that's not really true. We can always refuse to offer our consent and our affirmation that what they're saying is true. He said, and I'm going to read this from the book, we are not called upon to step out onto the square and shout out the truth, to say out loud what we think. This is scary. We're not ready, he writes. But let us at least refuse to say what we do not think. And that was the power of the powerless, to use a phrase that was used 3 years later by Václav Havel in a famous essay he wrote to the Eastern European dissidents that made the same basic point as Solzhenitsyn, that, you know, when we are powerless to change a system, we at least right. can refuse to say what we do not think.
Now, I think we're somewhere near the same age. And I want to ask you, but I'm 61. So, the great fact of the Soviet Union, the massive fact of the Soviet Union, framed so much of my childhood and adolescence. And, you know, I wanted to understand it, wanted to understand ideas. So I would read the Communist Manifesto. I actually got a hold of, you know, other Soviet propaganda and just read it. And by the way, none of it made sense, including the fact that even a 15-year-old in the United States could figure out the only thing that was true of their 5-year plans is that they never were successful at all. but it just became, you know, the whole Soviet experiment of horrifying repression. And yet I just think most people who are half my age might as well be hearing about the Holy Roman Empire. No, in other words, they just don't know. And that worries me because I think it worries me the way that so many of our Jewish friends in their 90s are worried that this far from the Holocaust, people think of it like Mesopotamia.
Right, right. Well, this is why they stress the importance of cultural memory, maintaining historical and cultural memory as a means of resistance. In the book, I quote a passage from the Czech dissident novelist Milan Kundera, who is putting words in the mouth of Gustav Husák, who is one of the communist dictators in Czechoslovakia. And he's addressing the youth saying, children, don't look back. Keep going into the progressive future, because the memory of history is a weight on them and allows them to have the people who remember history. It gives them something, a perspective by which to judge the present. And so in my book, Live Not by Lies, I had this amazing conversation with a young woman from California, 26 years old, college graduate, who happened to mention to me that she thought communism was a great idea. The Brotherhood of Man, what could be better than that? I looked at her and said, well, what about the gulags? She said, what? She honestly did not know about the gulags, did not know about the Soviet Union. Somebody had told her about communism and had given her the song and dance. But here she was, a college graduate in the United States of America, no idea.
But now let's go back to what you were answering in the larger culture. I agree with you, by the way. But I want to come back after you say what you say and press the point. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think the left has all the cultural high ground now. Make no mistake about it. They are controlling all the institutions. And it frustrates me to no end that conservative Christian friends of mine think that if we can only get the politics right, even at this late date, they think if we can only get the politics right, politics can turn it around. Look, it's important to vote. I mean, you look at the future of Christianity, I see the federal judiciary as being the last line of defense for Christian schools and institutions in the future to come. Nevertheless, politics and law cannot save us if the culture is rotten from within. And right now, I see so many Christian families who are looking for there to be a political solution, or they blame their pastors for not doing enough, when in fact they ought to be looking, we ought to be looking in interiorly and seeing what can we do in our families and in our churches and communities right now to build that resilience.
I realize this. One other thing I want to throw out is that I think Francis Fukuyama is right in his foreign affairs article of several years ago when he said that the only conservative grounding of any society in the modern age is a middle class. And if you eliminate the middle class, or you gain the influence of the middle class, you eventually will determine the future of the society. And the reason I raise that is because you mentioned the middle class in Russia, but it was very small, very, very small. And but you look at the middle class now in the English-speaking world, and it's basically giving up all the, I mean, the left say bourgeois values. Well, but the middle class values of marriage, fidelity, investing in children, thrift, hard work, labor, all those things are just being dissipated before our eyes. They were destroyed in the Soviet Union, but they're being eliminated here.
Coming up,
if we are going to have any hope at all of preserving Christianity, it has to begin by rebuilding the family.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. It can be daunting to watch the world around us changing so quickly. But the role that God has for each of us can really be quite simple. Renewal of personal conviction in front of Christ. And a renewal of commitment to the family unit as we work from there. Let's catch a few more minutes of Rod Dreher's conversation with Albert Mohler talking about Live Not by Lies. We'll pick up with Dreher's response to Mohler on the erosion of the family.
You know, you're saying that reminds me of having gone a few years ago to a conservative evangelical college to give a speech. This was maybe 7 years ago. And just having dinner with some of the professors before the speech, and I was asking them, what are you seeing among the students on campus? And one of the professors said, my greatest worry for them is that none of them will be able to form stable families. I looked at him astonished. I said, but this is a conservative, evangelical Midwestern college. How is this possible? He looked at me with tears in his eyes and said, because most of these kids have never seen a stable family. And I looked around the table and all the other professors were nodding. And that really kind of red-pilled me, because I had this romantic idea that this conservative evangelical school, this was going to be a bastion. But this man was telling me that, no, the culture has degraded so much, the culture of family, that these kids don't even, it doesn't even make sense to them. And I think that if we are going to have any hope at all of preserving Christianity, or even a memory of Christianity, it has to begin by rebuilding the family. And that begins by making choices ourselves and reinforcing those choices and helping young people to value marriage and having children and helping them do so.
I cannot recommend this book with more enthusiasm. Live Not by Lies by Rod Dreher, a manual for Christian dissidents. Rod, you're a friend. I'm very thankful for you as a co-laborer in this great task of building the resistance. And you've done a really good job now with this book joining the Benedict option and raising a lot of these issues. And you know, as a Baptist talking to an Eastern Orthodox believer, I'm in the position of saying I can go with you all the way on this book in a way that I actually couldn't with the Benedict option.
Right.
So you understand
what I mean. I
appreciate
you saying that. And, you know, one thing that I learned from this research and the travels in the Eastern Bloc is that when these Christians were thrown into prison, the denominational lines collapsed. It wasn't that they gave up denominational distinctives at all, but it's that the deep brotherhood they had in Jesus Christ came forth, and they helped each other and they prayed with each other. And it made me realize that when the secret police came for them, it didn't come because they were Protestant, didn't come because they were Catholic or Orthodox. The secret police came because they were followers of Jesus Christ.
For a link to the complete conversation with Rod Dreher, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed the program, take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. And never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.